description of those two men who were here from the Soviet Union, singing the praises of the Soviet Union. And for the long time, nobody knew, and then we found out that it was by the edict, the order of Stalin, through the guy that was there. Oh, I forget the name, of the guy who led up, and he was executed as the chief of the police. That was misleading Stalin. And Stalin, for a long time, imagine, was already a little bit confused in his mind, or thought that everybody was trying to get him and get the Soviet Union. And, of course, needless to say that what Khrushchev exposed about Stalin, all those things, you know. So, and then to live so long as to see it in my own life without anybody needing to tell me, because the whole world can't be off. Even if there's a percentage of it is true, even if 10% is true. So, at any rate, so then the question, how does one begin to tell you what the big things are?
Right.
So what I had in mind, I was going to talk about my experiences in my law cases, because I think I have had an unusual success, first myself and then the last 30 years, I think, that I practiced with my son together. And it had nothing, I don't know how much credit that should go to the International Labor Defense, because most of my union cases, I think, came through them. But I did very well before I actually learned about the International Labor Defense, that a lot of these union people did belong to it and heard of me and this and that and everything. Well, so it's a little hard, so let's see what...
Okay, I wonder if we could do...
Did we touch on whatever made me decide to take up the practice of law?
Yes, we did. I think what there's where I am...
That was the Debs
trial. Why don't we start with... you became involved with the union in about 1903, it seems, from all the old papers I looked through. Then you worked until your marriage, is that correct? In 1909, did you work all the way through till your marriage?
As a cigar maker.
Now, do you recall, did the union continue up by the time you quit when you married? Was the union still going?
Yes. There was a cigar makers union. Not all of the factories were organized. Those two early factories, as I told you, weren't. Later, as I told you, I went to work to, the name of that factory was a larger organization.
That was the one that you described as being more modern.
That was more modern. That was the first union shop that I worked in that one. And there was a fair lady. I didn't know what to make of her. I was always suspicious of foreman and fair ladies, because I figured those who were too friendly with the workers couldn't be in that position. So on a number of occasions, she called me away from my table where I was working, and she wanted to talk with me. That was before I was married, of course. I didn't work as a cigar maker after I was married. I didn't work. And she started to talk to me about things that had nothing to do with cigar making, you know. And I was a little suspicious of her, see. So I must have been rather icy or something, and I would say, oh, well, you surely know these things better than I do, you know, stuff like that. And she was a much older person anyhow. And then nobody one time to start called and tried to suggest how about dressing, how I should dress. And I just thanked her, and I saw it to myself. I thought, it's none of your goddamn business, you know. And little by little, I realized that she was not a friend of the workers, and I cautioned those that I was close to them that they should not become any confidence with her. Whenever we have to discuss matters regarding a strike or better conditions, something like that, we should know who our friends are, who our foes are. We can be outwardly, we can be civil with her, that's all. that's about my experience. I do not remember a strike in this big factory, because I think on the whole I was about 19 when I got married, so I didn't have an awful lot of time for working. And when I was married...
You said that you met your husband. You told me the story about when he and this other man came to the house and stayed as boarders. And then he went back to New York.
Yes.
And then he started to like you.
That's correct.
Now, there was a period of about 2 years or so then before you married?
I can't recall how much time elapsed, because they were rumored. I think they just went out of business. They were in business, I think, he and the other fellow. They were manufacturing brooms, and they put in all the money that the two had together. And so they came to Cleveland, and I don't know. I never paid too much attention. But we had a little, like a cottage, upstairs room and downstairs rooms, and they had a room upstairs. And I don't remember we got started talking politics or not, but I was the one that cigar factories while they were at the house. I think I told that episode about when they fixed the road with care. But how long that was, well, I noticed, I think there were daily letters. And now the family was the heck out of me, because I wasn't, I had no time or any interest to run around much with fellas or anything like that. And I don't think I was much of the kind that fellas would chase, you know. I remember even those days, I think people did use makeup and I didn't use any, on and on, at any rate. But there was Daily Mail and a constant rising and what have you. But how much time went by the time that he came back again, you know, and made it a point to live in Cleveland. I don't know what he did. I know what he did. I think he got a job on the streetcar as a conductor, streetcar conductor. And then after that, I could hear this, she's falling in love with a uniform. That business, you know.
So once he came back to Cleveland, then you started seeing each other.
Yes, and my father was opposed to him, because my father called him a forwardsite. Did you ever hear forwards, a Jewish newspaper, forwards? And to him, anybody who read the forwards was very radical. It was anti-religious and all that. My father was an Orthodox. As a matter of fact, my father was Hasid. A Hasid, I can never pronounce that right.
No,
he wasn't, in appearance he wasn't ridiculous, but he was pretty fanatic, although he had a marvelous sense of humor. They would enter into discussions, he and Dad didn't like his politics. He was a forwardsist. No, you don't need that kind, you know.
At that time, was he radical? At that time, was
according to my father, he was. In my opinion, I didn't have much, but when we started to talk about cigar making and so forth, I know he was very open-minded about it, and he gave me a few good hints on which side we are, you know.
But at that point, neither of you were socialists yet.
No. Neither of us were anything. And it was, one Passover night. I don't know, that it was slow. On the lighter side of life, but it was very serious to me already by that time. Because needless to say that I must have been pretty much flattered that. And he was a good-looking guy, and he was well-built, and well-dressed, and I said, well, I said to myself, what the heck is, did he see me? So, on Passover night, we had our Passover. We lived on the second floor. My parents lived in, I think, a two-family house. That's a different place by that time. And we lived on the second floor. And there was a porch off the living room, or the dining room, or both, you know. And there were no steps there. It was just the kind of porch that we could use from our home, not from the outside. And as we were having our, I think, finishing Passover, I looked out and there you were on the porch looking inside through the window, you know. And I waved him away to beat it, you know. And he did. And later he told me that it was Passover night, and he was thinking that all people, Jewish people, have Passovers and they're happy and all that. And he said he went into a restaurant to order something to eat, and finally, when the waiter came up to him, he said, well, just give me some matzah. And he said, I was sitting in the building at the matzah, and I was just thinking that there you are, you're working for the whole family, you must be serving and doing this and doing that, and your father must be praying all night and stuff like that, you know. Anyhow, it was the funniest thing to tell me that how I'm, afterwards, when he used to tell us something, he said, ah, that was Romeo and Juliet, because he crawled up on a post. I say he had it up the floor, climb up on a post, get up on the post to see him there. Well, at any rate, I got married at our home, and for my veil, I used some kind of a curtain, I think I had, but a veil that had to be a, Mother said it would not be a real wedding if it would be a marriage in the kosher. For my wedding ring, I got a loan from a cousin or an aunt. I think it was a cousin of Archer's, that's right. Her name was Mrs. Beckman. Wedding band, make my people believe it's like, because he was dead broke. Although he was working, he was getting income, but I wouldn't take any money from him. And even though we got that far and my mother was unhappy, my father was unhappy, and everybody had to console her because we were not staying in Cleveland. We were going to New York because his job was there. Here he had a temporary job there in New York. He had a conductor's job where he was on the regular route. Here he had to catch a sketch can. If somebody didn't show up, then he'd have to pull on everything, or his underwear and what have you, around to connect. At any rate, there's it. So that was the story. So we got married that way at home, and I, and my mother said, look, I'll tell Dad that you're keeping that veil. Dad didn't know it wasn't a regular veil. He wouldn't like it, because there's nothing too good for a parent's child, whether it's a girl or a boy or what have you. And just keep it, just for take for the fun. I said, I'll take it off. Kept it. And the ring, she says, is that a real ring? She says, oh, yes, yes. I said, it's a real ring. Not sure I gave it back to the only one I went. And that is the story. When we came to New York, we rented a room. And we had a little hot plate, had kitchen privileges there. And what was else did I have? I know I started out to make a real fancy, he used to come home for lunch, a real fancy lunch one day. And of all things, I decided to make, I think it was soup with matzo balls. I don't know whether I had any idea how to make it, but I know I made it. And the hot plate was a some kind of a plug in the gas where I could get gas. And the children were running around and playing, and they tripped over the and spilled the soup. Fortunately, the children weren't injured, but we had no lunch.
Well, your children were born in New York?
But we moved back to Cleveland just shortly before my first child was born. I had both children in Cleveland.
When was that then?
Well, you've got another Cherry. I think Cherry is 65.
So about 1910, then?
1910, I think. Mm. Well, we moved here a little before that.
Oh, so you stayed in New York just the 1 year?
Huh?
So you stayed in New York just about a
year? In New York, yes. Yes, we're in New York just about a year.
Now, what did you do with yourself during that time? You weren't involved in...
During that year in New York, let me see. Well, we went to live with an aunt of Archie's, and she was a widow, and she didn't mind having a little income she had from us, and she had a daughter whom I liked very much. She was, seemed to me, a progressive girl. I don't remember what she was doing. She was an older person than I was, and I said to her one day, I said, I haven't got enough to do to keep me from getting bored. I just don't like it. I'd go out, I'd sit on the stoop, what they call the stoop, there were no porches in New York. I'd try to read, but it was so noisy and interference. I said, I think I ought to go to work. She said, you think Archie would like it? I said, well, if you'd help me out, maybe he'd like it. You tell him it'll be better for me and better for both of you. Anyhow, we had a little talk, and he said, I don't like it, and I don't think she will like it, but if it's going to make her happy, you're all right. So, no, I worked some during that period in New York. And, still a cigar maker, nothing else, just a cigar maker.
In
New York, I didn't like it so well in New York, because I was a stranger there. And come to think of it, I think, I'm pretty sure, the story that I told you about that four lady, that was New York already. That was already New York. And that's when I was pretty suspicious, and that's when I used to have, my aunt was pretty nice. I used to have a few people over once in a while to talk to about what they should do, what they shouldn't do. And then I don't know what happened. Well, I didn't like to go to work anymore after it was beginning to look like all is not right with me. So from then on, I read that time, what I read the forwards, that was supposed to have been some kind of socialist paper at that time. And there was some reading matter there. I know that my aunt's daughter, that girl, was fairly progressive, and we had a lot to talk about indeed.
Did you go were you going to meetings other than union at this time, or it was still just...
No, there's no... in New York, I did not attend any union meetings, but I did have close relations with these girls, the other union people. But I'm trying to find it. Well, most of my activities in the union was in very early years. The very years I very active, that was it. That was my philosophy. My philosophy was unionism. I thought it was the only outfit for the workers. At that time, I didn't think too much yet about the isms.
You didn't see the broader, place it within a broader political framework then at that time.
Yeah. Later on, toward the end, by the time I got to New York, I felt that the union had to have some base there outside of just the unions, because I found that the most reactionary people were poor union people. As soon as they got someone out of the union, they liked it. When they didn't, they were out. Mm-hmm. It's a question of striking. You never got the reactionary union people to strike. You know, and if I argue with them, how's it ever going to get you if you're only going to nod your head yes to the boss, what you say, having a union? They say, oh, well, you're this and you're that, and anyhow, and you're a girl, and you're this and that. I had a lot of trouble with the men, the reactionary men.
How about with the more progressive men?
The progressive men, I had the very best relations.
They never...
With the progressive men, no, never. They would say, they used to say, well, we need more like you. We need more. In other words, I was an oddball or something, but we need more like you.
You know, when your husband said that he'd rather that you didn't work, did he feel this was going to be a reflection on his ability to support you if you worked?
He told that, gee, her name was Ida, I'm pretty sure, Captain. He said, Ida, I did not marry Etta for her to help me bring bread into the house. I am going to keep my regular route, and things will improve. I'll be getting longer hours, more working days, and she will not have to work. And she tried to tell him that it's not because I have to work. So he yielded, and he said, well, I don't want anybody to go around saying, oh, she's got a woman working for him. So in the end, that was there, see, because that's not what I married her for.
Mm-hmm. But by the time you went into law, he no longer had that attitude then.
Well, by the time I went into law, a lot of water said, well, by the time I went into law, I had two grown children. I told you that my oldest son and I graduated at the same time. So I raised the family during those years. My occupation was following socialist speakers. You know, Debs was my idol, one of my idols anyhow. I don't remember that there have been others. And C.E. Rutenberg. And then an author with Against the War, fighting against the First World War. And
what sort of thing did you do in fighting against the First World War?
First World War, attend a lot of speakers, meetings, go to a lot of meetings many times. We attended meetings when the children were little, very little. I don't remember how often I had somebody stay with the children. I don't think I could afford it. But the children were with me, and they got to know what a meeting is when they were little. They knew all about it. They knew what a good speaker was and a bad speaker, and especially I liked Edgar Van Guest. I forgot his name. At any rate, he's the one that Jerry, when Jerry was a little fella, asked him a question during the question period. I don't know if I told you that or not.
So the children were very politically conscious from an early age?
Yes, they were what I was, they felt must be good, see? So that was that. That's all they knew. In later years, they didn't like it so well. In later years, they were saying, well, isn't there anyone else doing these things? Do you have to do all these things? Well, I have it thrown at me now. My sister, do you have to do all that? If the organization is going to dissolve, let it dissolve. You have to hold it up under the arms and all that stuff, because we lost from my last count is 49 members. We can count a maximum of 20 now. And out of those that were lost, 29, more than half are baited by death. Just have problems with that. Others are in rest homes, and a couple are disabled at home. So, but people who can come to meetings still are few. Yeah, that means when something has to be done, I have the paperwork and I have the physical work. Like we have this coming Wednesday, going away farewell party for a couple that are here. Short time, they did excellent work for grassroots. We have a newspaper here, and it's the Berkeley Grassroots. It really is a grassroots paper, very progressive paper. And they're both photographers, they take pictures and they write articles, and they help to edit the paper, and they do a lot of stuff. But they're leaving, so we're making going away parties, we're making luncheon.
Most of your life then, people were always, saw you as doing too much.
Yes, so that I say I have, that is, when I'm through here, I go to bed and I get up, and if I can feel sure my sister won't barge in on me, she rings the bell, so I always keep things away so it doesn't look as though I'm doing kitchen work paperwork, she's used to seeing me. But kitchen work, I try to keep it out of sight, you know.
Well, yet
at any rate, that is a story. So the children felt that I, nevertheless, it didn't stop my younger son from, he made a trip to the Soviet Union.
But that was that early?
Huh?
When was that? Mm-hmm.
That's a younger one. That must have been shortly after the revolution.
Oh.
Shortly after the revolution, was quite a young lad. He didn't stay very long because the language is a barrier. But he went with Anna Louise Strong, and there's another internationally known woman. They had a nice trip going, and I don't know how he came back without her, without them, I guess. And then it didn't stop him from joining the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in the Civil War in Spain.
Is it the youngest?
The youngest one, that's the one.
Now, was he killed in Spain?
No, no. When he was leaving Spain, it was pretty much the end, pretty much the end of the war. He was the last skirmish, and he was hit by shrapnel here, and it healed very nicely. And when some of his friends wanted to ask me, Sandy, you already had one dimple, what did you make another one for, and all that stuff. At any rate, that was that. And Jerry, well, I'll tell you the extent of my children's life in the, as far as socialism and communism are concerned. Jerry was an A student from the cradle to the grave, as far as education is concerned, in elementary school and in high school and in college. And while he was at the Western Reserve, what the heck, where was it? He, I don't know, one final exam for something, exam to enter college, I believe. It must have been a pre-med, he's going to take medicine.
Oh, he didn't plan initially on life.
Huh?
He didn't plan initially on life.
No. He was preparing himself for medicine. And he said he felt he could do most for the people that way, in the medicine. And he knew that all he had to do was take the exam and that's that, because he had A's all the time. And they were preparing for, I don't know what kind of a dances that the groups have after they take their finals, where they take out a young lady to dance and so forth. And he was preparing and putting on his... and then somebody went downstairs and got the mail and handed him the mail. And I heard a strange scream from his bedroom, and he handed me the paper that he did not make it. He says, Mother, he says, I know I made enough for two men to graduate. He says, I don't understand it. By that time I was practicing the law and handling all the controversial cases. And I was labeled redder than red before I myself knew what I was, see. And there was one doctor, though, that I handled very much in streetcar injuries. There used to be a lot of streetcar injuries in Cleveland. They were very careless, you know, and they'd stop the car and people would fall down and get hurt, or shut the door and bang someone in. It's very, very careless. There were no rules protecting the public, you know. So there's a lot of streetcar accidents. And I had those cases. So there was one, I'll never remember, I thought I'd never forget his name, but an elderly man, a doctor, that examined my clients, and the streetcar company's doctor examined my clients also, and they gave different versions. Anyhow, I thought I'd go to him. I said, I took some of his sheriff's papers I always had with me. I don't know if I still have them in my family files. And I said, "Doctor, Jerry would know." "You don't know Jerry," of course, he didn't know him. I said, "You don't know him." "No," he says, "but if he's got any kind of a head like you've got, I know he couldn't have flunked that goddamn test. But I can tell you why he didn't make it. And you're naive if you don't know it. You expect any boy to be permitted into the practice of medicine with a mother like you? They'll see to that they won't. Even if it's somehow, if somebody wasn't on his toes and didn't manage to flunk him, they managed somehow to keep him out of the practice because they don't want any weird doctors." I said, "What has Sherry got to do with me, assuming I was weird? What's the guy?" "Well, again, I'm telling you, if you ask anybody, and if they'll ask me, I'll say it on the witness stand."
Mm-hmm.
"See? You know, I'm not afraid," and he wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
"So he was too big a man to for them to live or read around him." But Sherry couldn't. Youth, I tell you, youth is wonderful. I don't remember how old he was at that time, but he went to that dance. I said, "You go ahead to the dance. We'll talk it over. We'll think about it. You go to the dance." And he went to his dance, and anyhow, we talked about it and said, "All right, we can battle it. I intend to battle. I battle other people's cases. I battle yours, too. But in the meantime, would you be interested to switch to the study of law, to study law?" He says, "I'll compromise with you. I'll take you up on something. I'll switch to become your secretary for a while. And I'm not exaggerating when I tell you he's the best secretary I ever had. He's an excellent typist. I don't know where or how he learned it, but he did in connection with work, whether for shorthand or typing. And I didn't have to sit in front of the dictionary all the time or to check up on his spelling. He was an excellent student. And I enjoyed having him as the secretary. By that time, he became interested in the law, in working on my papers, and he took up the study of law.
Oh,
and that's how he became a lawyer.
So did you ever go ahead and try and fight the issue, though, or did you just drop it then about
this? I took it up with a lot of people, and I found that the doctor was right morally, but legally he didn't have a foot to stand on. Nobody would agree that the medical profession is keeping reds or progressives out. But I do know there were a few progressives in the medical that happened to be my own doctor. There were gross two doctors who had a hell of a time because they were too progressive and so forth. So I knew that that was the medical profession. And somehow the legal profession seems, once they got in, if I were a starving lawyer, they'd treat me with sympathy, I think. But I was not a starving lawyer. When they were starving, when they were closing the offices, I had lineups. They weren't all clients. Many of them were for handouts, and they got it too, you know. That they didn't like. So the byline of the practicing lawyers after that, although they would talk with me and try to be nice, when they went after a case that I already had, they'd say, "You don't know Mrs. Lyon?" "Yeah, we know about her." "Well, you know she doesn't have any chance with a judge." So they say to them, "How about a jury?" "Oh, jury, the jury find out who she is." At any rate, that's why I had it. But that was the extent of my children. They suffered, see. They suffered from the jury suffered. He wanted to be a doctor, and if he'd be as good a doctor as he was a lawyer, he'd be a good doctor.
And how about the youngest?
And the younger one was not a student. he was the more brilliant of the two. But he couldn't apply himself to taking exams, to studying. He wanted to travel, he wanted to do things, he wanted action, you know. So he didn't do too much, but when he went to Spain, I don't remember, so he was doing odd jobs, I don't remember, photography, he was in photography. But when was his last position when he came back from Spain? Oh yes, he got tied up with a discount outfit. I forget the name of the outfit. And before very long, he was their buyer and he was their manager, and he was forever traveling on behalf of them. But oh yes, he took a pilot. That's what he wanted. He wanted to become a pilot, a flyer, and he was a pilot, private pilot.
He didn't fly in Spain, though.
He didn't fly in Spain. But his profession was pilot already.
Mm-hmm.
When he went to Spain. But I know he was in charge of transportation in Spain,
mm-hmm.
And he told us many sad stories about Spain. At any rate, he became executive in this discount company, and he was on the trip from Mexico. They had branches in Mexico here and there, and his two children were at my house. See, I don't remember how it was, because since he went, this went very, that took very, he was on his way home from his trip, I know, but we were planning a family gathering Friday, Saturday, the Saturday before this happened. Mm-hmm. This happened on a Friday, I think. And he ran into an ice cloud. And he ran into an ice cloud, a fin, or the wing, I think the official name is fin, was cut off from the, you see the fin when the plane is flying, is a kind of heat,
mm-hmm.
that a human being couldn't touch. But that fin touched the iceberg, and one fin was cut off, and that was the end of it. According to the report, I read the report, the coroner's report, the pilot had the presence of mind to shut off the engine so they did not burn.
Mm.
But his death was caused by a multiple of fractures. When they crashed down.
What year was that, Yetta?
Huh? 60. Oh. Well, that was the closest thing to deranging me at anything, because he was not even so important to me. He was important to everybody who knew him. And I know one day a cousin got us over the telephone. And she said, well, listen, you should be proud of him. He was such an important person to everybody. Well, that was so bad. I said, please don't say it. Let's not talk anymore. And I had to hang up. At any rate, that is the extent of... And being a businessman, being the executive, the company knew what I was. And they knew that if he had to choose sides, he'd always choose my side. And he always advocated to the other executives and owners that don't call yourself a discount company. Give the people a discount. You can afford it. You'll get it from volume. Not to get it out of the blood of a human being. They used to give that. They said, oh, I forget. Yet a land son. Yet a land son. Well, that was extent. But and that's it.